Tonight, we seek new maps to guide us on high alert. Radical geographer Esteban Kelly discusses maps as instruments of world-bending social change. We map the human mind with esoteric author and paratheatrical researcher Antero Ali. And finally, we look at Suki, a web app that helps protesters avoid overly rambunctious police officers. How do they do it? With maps! Hold on to your ears, you're on high alert!
My blood pressure.
It's good?
Yeah, it's super good.
No diabetes?
Too low, actually.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, not abnormal, like, not in low, but...
Yeah. Hey, you're listening to High Alert. I'm George Spinbinder.
I'm Alex P. Megalus. I was talking about my health and well-being just now and the fact that I went to see my GP and my dentist this week. But that's none of your business.
No, your business right now is being on High Alert. I'm Tebow.
I once again am George Spinbinder.
So we're talking about maps on High Alert today. Maps to guide us.
New maps to guide us.
New maps to guide us. And this is a conversation that began shortly after, as you may recall, our last edition of the High Alert podcast. We were hard-pressed to come up with a topic to follow up the awesomeness of last edition. And I think initially the idea came up to do a show on social movements. Montreal right now, there's tons of stuff that's going on in the streets.
Tension on the street.
And so we wanted to do a show that would reflect that and also address what's going on at a global level. But that kind of ended up taking us in a different direction.
So, George, in order to kind of broaden the topic, because we didn't only want to stand like or focus on the social movement, decided to call the show
New Maps to Guide Us,
which left it way more open to explore other things like new maps to guide our understanding of experiences and different kinds of experiences.
Or the human mind.
As
maps that can be a representation of a physical landscape that can be connected to power struggles. When we talk about maps, we can always ask the questions, and that's actually one of the questions that our first guest is going to be asking.
That's right.
But who produces the map? Who stands to gain by what it represents?
That's right.
And what does the map not show?
That's right. To applications and technology using maps.
Using maps to avoid being arrested by brute-fisted police officers.
And the practice of kettling.
So this is our exploration of maps. Episode 2, you are on High Alert. And our first guest.
So our first guest is Esteban Kelly. Is a Philadelphia-based activist, community organizer, academic. Esteban is someone whom I've admired for a few years now. I met him, about 2 years ago in Ann Arbor, Michigan, when I first attended the annual conference organized by the North American Students for Cooperation. And so he's going to be our first guest. And he's going to tell us about the practice of being a radical geographer. Can you please introduce yourself and tell us what your life is about these days?
My life is about these days. I might ask for another level of detail about that, but it's my kid's birthday today. But she's just one, so it's a day like any other for her. We're running around trying to make dinner. So my name's Esteban Kelly, and I blog at Black Maps, and it's just me. It's my project. my life is a little all over the place. I am working on a PhD in anthropology, studying urbanization in Sao Paulo as a megacity, and looking at sort of different ideologies of space and how people share a city of 20 million people, which, I don't know, kind of blows my mind, so I want to dissertate about it. And I also work at a food co-op in Philadelphia. I live in West Philly, and I also recently started up a worker co-op, which does consulting and training for collectives, for worker co-ops, for food co-ops, all different kinds of co-ops, and grassroots organizations and nonprofits that are working towards social justice, that are working to build this thing that we call a solidarity economy, and working toward economic justice. So we do participatory trainings, strategic planning, and the group itself is called AORTA, which stands for Anti-Oppression Resource and Training Alliance. And I'm a new parent. I am a dad of 1 year. And that is its own crazy adventure. So I am starting to write about that in and of itself, in sort of a political and also public intellectual context. You know, what does it look like to parent from a anti-capitalist perspective, from a queer and feminist perspective? Even what does it look like to be on what I like to call double dad duty, where my kid has two dads? So those are some of the things that I'm up to. Let me know if you want to know more. I can go on about some of the like regional organizing and whatever. But
on your site, you identify as a radical geographer. Can you tell us about the intersection of radicalism and geography?
Radical geography is a term that actually it has an intellectual tradition. It comes from some radical social theorists in, I want to say, the 70s, who were thinking about human geography and thinking about ways of conceptualizing representations of our world and how we map and track the movement of capital, the movement of people, borders, representational space, identities, all of those things that are bound up in the discipline of geography, the disciplines of sociology, anthropology, all of those things. So it's an intellectual tradition. Henri Lefebvre is one of the sort of godfathers, grandfathers, if you will, of radical geography, and has many essays and books on the term. And also is really prominent in an early book or volume or edited edition that came out in the 70s, includes a lot of sort of famous public thinkers and geographers such as David Harvey, who are really talking about what are ways that we can sort of look at, and let's be real, they were coming from a Marxist framework, but to take a Marxist critique of, which is not to say that they are Marxists per se, but just people who have studied and utilize Marx's critiques and understandings of capital and capitalism, as well as colonialism, imperialism, a lot of the isms, to understand our world in a different way. So radical geography, yeah, God, I hope I just said it. Radical geography in a nutshell is the premise of taking traditions that are critical and using lenses that are visual and using a topos, a representation of space, through maps, through plotting out relationship, space, and time, and seeing what is productive that comes out of that. What are ways that we can understand where accumulation is happening, accumulation of capital and resources? So, for example, this critique that came out of a lot of the mid-20th century, sort of post-World War II era, a critique that was actually launched by theorists from the Global South or Third World scholars was really looking at, oh, hey, you guys, it seems like the Global North has a lot of resources and is like all developed and stuff. And it's not just that we woke up one morning and that happened because you have more white people than we do and white people are better or smarter, but actually that this was a process that unfolded over 450 years of dispossessing people of color, of dispossessing countries, nations, lands from the Global South of their resources, of their wealth, in order to accumulate it through capitalist processes in the Global North. And so that is an example of just understanding our world, understanding the spatial geography of this. And I think that in our sort of late capitalist mode, it's this idea that, okay, it isn't quite as simple as that. And imperialism isn't quite as simple as, oh, you have some colonies, so there's something going on there that links you to some imperialist power. But rather that even inside of a place like Philadelphia, for example, you have sites that have accumulated capital and other sites that are utterly abandoned, where you've got houses that are collapsing in, and other places where, you know, Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie are staying in fancy hotels in Rittenhouse Square in the center city of Philadelphia while they're doing photo shoots down the block. So it's ways of understanding that. How does this help us map and understand foodscapes and food systems and food access and food justice? How does that help us understand, you know, all sorts of politics? And I think we see this also with the recent articulation of the 99% movement.
How is radical geography well situated to make sense of the times that we live in?
I think radical geography is a particularly useful tool for helping us understand the historical moment that we're in, the political moment, the economic moment that we're in, because a lot of the stuff that's going on is, frankly, hard to digest. It's not really straightforward. And my own perspective is that's not particularly new, that capitalism's taken a sinister and discrete turn since the 70s and financialization. The idea that people are sort of trading money and delinking from the gold standard, that all of that suddenly meant that, you know, every day people on the street didn't necessarily have the fullest grasp on what the hell was going on. And so I think that what's really exciting about the potential of radical geography and also of comics and just visual media is that it helps us break down these broad and complex systems into something that that we can see and understand better, something that we can communicate about, information that we can assemble into representations that can convey a lot of things that are going on. So you can think of things like, you know, all the information that's in a graph that might show things like, you know, a pie chart of ownership or of wealth or of hunger or food security, right? And seeing how that breaks down in terms of class, how that breaks down in terms of gender, how that breaks down in terms of nationality or in terms of percentage of the world's population, who has access to what, right? So if you extrapolate that same idea to maps, the idea that can be placed in space, I don't always mean in, you know, Cartesian or in what we understand as, like, you know, like NASA satellite images of real space, but also representations of space. That even things like Google Maps are a representation. That's not what's actually happening. There's this really incredible Borges piece where he talks about. Do you know what I'm talking about? I'm looking at you. Okay, there's this really incredible Borges piece where he talks about this colonial society where the king says, hey, I've got this colony. I want you to make a map of it. And they make this map, and the king sees it and is like, that's cool, but it's not a very true representation because the scale is just so out of whack, And in order to have a sense of this, I need something that is more real. And so the cartographers sort of go out and they make something that's like the size of like a whole room in the palace of this imperial sort of king. And the king's like, wow, that's great. I have like a much better sense of like, you know, how long does it take to get from this part of my new realm to this other part? How far is the port from this capital city in our colony, right? But it still is like only one millionth of, you know, the size. And so this goes on and on and on until people, they're freaking out about like really just needing to be true to the ideal of representation until at last they've made a one-to-one scale ratio of the map of this colony, you know, which obviously would take up the size of an entire country. So this is like really interesting idea that Borges is talking about, like where, like at to what extent are we really tripping over representation, and is a map of a place, even if it is scalar to that degree, is that even a true copy of, you know, all the different complexities and dimensions of space? So I think what's important is to remember and take stock of the ways in which you're always leaving something out. Maps are always leaving something out, that there's an incredible amount of power that's concentrated in the practice of map making, in the practice of distributing maps. And, you know, the most famous map of the world is a gross exaggeration. It has all these biases that really, first of all, centralize the Northern Hemisphere. Because it cuts out giant, vast amounts of oceans in the Southern Hemisphere, oftentimes just completely neglects the existence of Antarctica, which is one of the seven continents. So all of these things, and it's just sort of like, yeah, that's just sort of taken for granted, and it's hanging on, hanging in school classrooms throughout the world, and in boardrooms, and in, you know, even in naval navigation rooms, that this is this way that so much of the world has come to understand what our planet is, that there's an incredible amount of power in that. So, you know, if a picture's worth 1,000 words, I think that a map is worth, you know, 1,000,000, right? It's worth a dissertation, that there's so much that goes into a map. So I think radical geography, to go back to that sort of point, is that radical geography forces us to ask questions of maps, to look at where is power? What are the silences in a map? What is not being represented? Who made the map? Who funded the map? In whose interest are the representations that are being portrayed in the map? And how is that biased? Whether that's, you know, for poor people, for rich people, right, for whatever. But that there are always biases and choices that are being made. And on the other side of it, they're incredibly powerful in being able to distill and simplify in an image, in a glimpse, of incredible amount of information.
I wanted to ask you to comment on Hakim Bey's theory of the temporary autonomous zones, in which Hakim Bey talks about the pirate coves of the 1700s, which existed before the world was fully mapped, and which allowed pirates to exist and thrive free of social oppression, and to grow as a revolutionary movement. Hakim Bey situates the autonomous zones of the 1700s in relation to our current times, where he feels that the world has been fully mapped, and so we experience a challenge in living autonomously. How do you feel about this? Do we have the capacity to experience autonomy in a world that is fully mapped? And if so, how?
I would question the idea that our world is fully mapped. It reminds me a lot of the Malthusian scares around, you know, around hunger, that there's this idea of finality and finite. It's just, it's incredibly presumptuous that we know how much food we can yield and how much people we can, how many people we can feed, and therefore this is the moment that there's going to we're going to hit this collapse, this critical moment where oops, it's a crisis of hunger and then everything's going to implode. It's incredibly presumptuous to assume that we have mapped everything. I mean, I live in a fairly large city. It's the fifth largest city in the United States, and I don't even think that our city, which has blueprints for ostensibly for every building, you're not supposed to build anything without getting a permit from City Hall. It's incredibly controlling. They don't even have our city mapped, right? Like I was mentioning earlier, there are abandoned spaces throughout the city. There are activities that happen in space. Do you know where all the drug deals are taking place? Do you know where Food Not Bombs is feeding people on the sly? Do you know where people are meeting for anonymous sex or non-anonymous public sex? Let alone the whole spatial dimension of the internet and web space and ways in which people are having all kinds of activity, meetings, conference calls that are not that are aspatial. They're happening in our world. They're happening in places. People are creating places, and I don't mean in like a Farmville kind of way, but that there are real intersections. There are real rendezvous that take place that are beyond the state. The fact of the matter is that the state is in constant crisis, that there's too much going on our planet for science or capitalism or the state or the man to ever be able to completely capture. And so I don't agree with the initial premise of where Hakim Bey is coming from. I think that there are, if we take that as a given, it pushes us into a moment, a different moment of crisis, where we yield a whole lot generously to the state, in assuming that they have knowledge and control over everything, which they really don't. And that's not true for all of us, right? That's true in prisons. That is true in hospitals, in mental institutions. That's true in schools. Right, but that's precisely why it's very important that we develop an analysis and an understanding of those institutions and the ways in which people are being policed. I think the idea of having space known or mapped or watched it has a lot of resonance with critiques of policing and both the prison and military industrial complex. But I think that everyday life is a cacophony of just, you know, untraceable, unknowable things, happenstance. You don't know that you're going to bump into your friend on your way to the train or the post office. You discover a secret garden. You discover a patch of wildflowers, or you discover fireflies that you notice in this one spot at sunset on your commute home. That these things aren't, that's a place, that you map that in your head. There's a moment of like, that place is dope. I want to bring my sweetheart there. I want to go drink beer in that one place down by the water on my birthday to celebrate it. That there's so many dimensions to place, let alone an emotional landscape that just isn't part of that. So the idea of like, where can we be autonomous? I don't see as scarcity. I think that we need to really see our world, our place, our homes, our neighborhoods, our cities as abundant. That there's a multitude of places where we have complete control, and not in the way that not in an authoritarian sense, that we have autonomy to come together to. In accidental and unplanned ways, as well as strategic planned ways that are productive spaces and generative spaces of theory and of critique and of struggle and of organizing, all of those things. And I think that in terms of economic justice, in terms of community ownership. I think that the whole idea there is that we are carving out spaces that are unconquered or that are reclaimed from capitalism, from corporations, from the state, that we own, that are autonomous. I mean, the idea that there are cooperatives where there are buildings that are owned by the community or by a collective of people, or that there are grocery stores that are owned that way, or urban farms that are owned that way, is an autonomous zone. And I think that there's a lot of power in having the spaces like that that aren't temporary, but that are perennial and that provide an anchor for fighting back or growing and reclaiming more and other spaces.
You're listening to High Alert, where our theme tonight is new maps to guide us. To send communication through to Alex, Tebow, and George, contact info@highalert.net. Find us on Twitter @HighAlertShow. Keep your ears on High Alert!
Everyone who's listening right now really needs to look at George Spinbinder's rock-out face.
Yeah, the medium of podcasting and radio does not actually allow our audience to look at us, Alex.
But our audience should know that the music you hear is done by our very own George Spinbinder.
That's right. That particular piece was pitched in by the good old Mr. Shane Watt, a Montreal legend.
That's right. And you're listening to High Alert. The theme of the show is New Maps to Guide Us. And our next guest is Antero Ali. And Antero Ali is an American who wrote books, he's a professional astrologer and filmmaker. And has a theatrical productions in Berkeley, California. And what interested me to Antero Ali's work was his work and research on the Eighth Circuit Mind, based on Timothy Leary's work and Robert Anton Wilson's work.
I was first introduced to the Eighth Circuit Brain when I stumbled upon it in Robert Anton Wilson's book, The Cosmic Trigger. And that was back in 1979, 1980. And it just so happened that around that time, I became part of a monthly group that met at Bob Wilson's house. And so I got to meet with him in person and discuss all manner of things, you know, back when he was pretty much in his prime. He's no longer with us. He passed away a few years ago. What interested me in the Eighth Circuit Brain System, which Bob extrapolated from an earlier development from Timothy Leary, who extrapolated it from a rather mysterious source only referred to in Timothy in his book, What Does Woman Want?, where he discloses the true origins of the Eighth Circuit Brain as a process, a discussion that he was having with a Rutgers University scholar, a Hindu scholar, who introduced Leary to a certain esoteric version of the chakra system. And I say esoteric version of the chakra system because, you know, throughout the 1980s, the whole New Age movement, the term chakras had become really commercialized, and everybody thinks they know what chakras are. So this is way back in the early 60s when Leary was introduced to the notion of an esoteric chakra system.
To these eight circuits of the mind or of the brain, would you be able to describe, for example, what these circuits are?
Oh, well, they have various labels, and just very briefly, the first circuit refers to our most basic biological intelligence that... At the most basic level, the person who has a high level of first circuit intelligence is basically those of us who know how to feed ourselves and to find shelter and to figure out how to physically survive on the planet. And so first circuit intelligence is all about, you know, figuring out physical survival.
When does this intelligence, I mean, when does it come into being, this intelligence?
Oh, what a great question. What I've discovered is that, I want to kind of trace it back to something that, a discovery that Leary posited, I thought was his really most brilliant contribution to the system, and that is by examining the trinary function of the neuron, which is basically the most, it's the most basic unit of biological intelligence, mm-hmm. the neuron, and its trinary function of absorbing, storing, and transmitting information and or energy, pretty much it doubles as a working definition of intelligence, which is our capacity to absorb, integrate, and transmit information and or energy. So people become, for example, physically more intelligent to the degree that they can be open to absorbing physical life and physical experience and then finding ways to integrate or make that experience their own and then find ways to communicate or connect that experience to, you know, the world and, you know, to other people maybe. So this trinary function of being able to absorb, integrate, and transmit experience throughout all the eight levels presents a kind of map or a model for increasing intelligence through, you know, multiple functions of intelligence. And since each of the eight have their own unique agendas or unique ways of being, one way of being intelligent is not necessarily going to apply to another. And what I mean by that is that, you know, you see, you have people who can be very intellectually very bright, very smart, but socially, you know, they may be, you know, pardon the phrase, they may be idiots, like mm-hmm. social idiots, not knowing how to get along with people. And then you have people who are, you know, socially very intelligent, you know, the most socially intelligent person in the room is usually the one that can get along with the most variety of number of people. And so we find that the system can act as a practical measure to discover where we may already be possessed of intelligence without realizing it, but also where we are still possessed of a certain ignorance or a lack of integration or transmission of certain experiences in life.
So these circuits or these maps serve as a way to be able to identify where our strengths are and our weaknesses?
Oh, very much so. I mean, you know, when I started this study of the eight circuits, it became very clear that I was what I would call, you know, a social idiot, you know, where I had, you know, the least amount of intelligence in the social area of my life. I wanted to figure out a way to get along with more different types of people. I didn't want to isolate myself. I wanted to increase my social intelligence. And so I set about, for example, my own experiments. I set about going to a number of different parties and gatherings and certain social events that in my intellect, you know, I would have a bias and say, well, I can't mix with those people or I don't know how to relate with those people. Well, what I did was I just put myself into that situation anyway and simply learned in the moment how to get along with this group or that gathering or this particular event. And eventually I started learning how to get along with more different types of people and my social intelligence began increasing.
Wow. So by identifying what, let's say, you were you lacked of,
yes.
and by exposing yourself
yes.
to what you felt was uncomfortable, you developed that certain intelligence, that fourth circuit.
Yeah, and it came about from a, you know, just a burning motivation to you know, not remain a social idiot. It was embarrassing to me. I just wanted to, you know, evolve and grow like anybody else.
And I think that goes back also to the courage that you have and that openness to experience that you have.
See, that's the thing. I think that's a real prerequisite to you know, any kind of evolution or growth or development of intelligence or any kind of, you know, in pushing the boundary or stretching the envelope of your limitations and such. You know, you have to really have heart. You have to show courage to do that, I think.
Hmm. So you were talking about the first circuit being something that is related to fear and safety.
Very much so, yeah.
How would you describe that, let's say, in real-life term, how someone, let's say, who has a very strong first circuit, how would they act?
Well, someone with a strong first circuit shows physical confidence. And what that means is that, you know, they're in a position in their life where they have earned, through various experiences, enough confidence that they know that no matter what happens, they're going to be able to survive. And, you know, everybody has to come to their own level of physical confidence in their own way. There's no, you know, one particular way I think you can do that because, you know, people's nervous systems differ and their upbringing differs and, you know, their conditioning and so forth differs. So the 8th Circuit brain system really takes into account the, you know, the diversity of the human condition. And I think, well, Albert Einstein has a couple of great questions that he posed. He says these are basically the two most important questions any human being could ask themselves. And he says the first question is, what is intelligence? Define it. And the second question is, okay, according to your definition of intelligence, how would you go about increasing it? And so right away it places the responsibility and really the autonomy in the hands of the individual to dare to be so audacious as to begin defining the terms of their existence and their life.
And for example, someone who would have an underdeveloped or a weak first circuit, what kind of exercise that you, these exercises that you can find in your book, Angel Tech, would you propose for someone to be able to strengthen that first circuit?
Well, you know, again, it depends on the individual because it's not really kind of a one-size-fits-all situation. I'd have to really discover a little bit more about the nature of that particular individual. But basically, you know, when we're talking about increasing first circuit or physical, you know, confidence, you know, it has to do with the person's relationship to their with their physical body, you know, the foods that they're eating, if they're getting enough exercise, you know, the degree of their physical health and well-being, their relationship or lack of relationship to that. These are all of these are tying into, you know, the most basic biological concerns that the first circuit represents. And second circuit, you know, goes into a more complex level of emotional survival. You know, our experiences of winning and losing, you know, whether it be, you know, on a daily basis or are we winning and losing in our lives, and you know how to develop some emotional strength and emotional confidence, and I think that really comes down to the courage to express your true feelings and you know dare to live a more emotionally honest life.
Does the strength of, for example, the first circuit, this kind of fear and safety, or the second circuit, this kind of emotional strength or weakness, does it come by accidental experiences, or?
Well, it's both. You know, any kind of experience, whether you know, experiences are thrust upon us, or you can create an experience. I think, again, you know, the 8th Circuit grid is simply that. It's a grid, it's a map to help individuals if they want to begin somehow measuring some degree of their own intelligence and or lack of intelligence on a number of different levels. You know, the 3rd Circuit, you know, refers to conceptual or intellectual intelligence. How good are we at solving our own problems? How good are we at making the maps that guide us in our own existence, and you know the will to reason, to be able to, you know, basically figure out your own life and your own survival. 4th circuit, I already mentioned a little bit, you know, social survival. And then when we get into the upper circuits, you know, it's a whole different ball game up, you know, in the upper circuits. And when I say upper and lower circuits, it by no means, there's no hierarchy, there's no you know, I'm not talking from a point of view where the I'm looking at the upper, you know, as any better than the lower circus. In fact, my bias is actually more towards emphasizing the lower circuits.
That's interesting, because Timothy Leary and a lot of Robert Anton Wilson were, the focus was on the higher circuits.
Well, that's exactly right, but their backgrounds were more as individuals identified as intellects.
Mm.
My background is more of an artist and a theater person, and so I function from a more, what I call, an embodiment bias.
Right.
And so I tend to move towards any kind of philosophy or metaphysic or whatever psychology system, as long as my body, I can take my body with me, as long as I'm free to embody whatever idea or principle or, you know, process is presented. I can't just, you know, sit back and, you know, enjoy my theories about it. I have to do things with it.
Mm. And that's what you're saying about one of the contributions that you've made about developing the eight-circuit brain is bringing it back to the body.
Pretty much, yeah. I haven't really... I've seen a little bit of that with Bob Wilson's in his Prometheus Rising, but I just pretty much went all the way with not just Angel Tech, which I wrote, you know, almost 30 years ago, but the follow-up book... I decided I needed to write a book after 25 years of studying this, another book to advance Angel Tech, and that's called The Eighth Circuit Brain. And that just came out just a couple years ago, and that deals with far more specific areas of application of tasks and meditations and rituals to access these functions of intelligence and to see where you really stand in your own life with them.
And when you're talking about studies and research, what kind of studies and research are you talking about?
Well, my studies and research are all focused in what I call paratheater. And this is a ritual technology for self-initiation that I've been developing for the last 35 years that combines techniques of theater, dance, song, and zazen meditation in a kind of non-performance modality. So the pressure to perform is released, and it's replaced by more self-created or internal pressures to begin increasing our commitment basically to direct experience or to our capacity to experience, you know, these various energy centers or levels of consciousness more directly. So we come into some firsthand knowledge of the energies and the experiences. And then we can develop some ideas and beliefs about them afterwards.
Mm. So you start with the experience and a way of, with this type of free-flowing theater of reuniting mind and body.
Yeah.
And then in those experiences, you can map out some of the certain circuits that are maybe being activated.
Yeah, that's my bias again. You know, my bias is more Gnostic or with gnosis of, you know, going for the direct experience first and then developing, seeing what kind of theories come afterwards. Otherwise, I feel like I'm, you know, just spinning around in my own head, chasing a theory, hoping it's true or something.
Mm-hmm. So we're getting to the fifth circuit.
Mm.
How would you describe that fifth circuit?
Well, the fifth circuit is it's a very simple. It refers to a very simple experience of being here now. It's simply our capacity to be in the present, relatively free of suffering and anxiety. And so, meditation can bring this about. Sometimes, just naturally, people enter a state of well-being, or maybe they're falling in love, or some process of joy and happiness comes into their lives, and the present moment is a wonderful place to be. There's you know, free of suffering and anxiety again are good indications of a fifth circuit opening, where you can actually simply be here now.
So looking at a sunset or talking with a good friend, being completely... absorbed in a conversation would be a fifth circuit.
Especially if it's bringing about a sense of pleasure and moving you into a more blissful or an ecstatic state. The fifth circuit, each of the upper circuits becomes activated with its own unique shock. And the unique shock of the fifth circuit is the shock of ecstasy. And, you know, anybody that's been in a genuinely ecstatic state, you know, it's really puts you in a different trance. It's a whole different kind of way of feeling and being than, let's say, ordinary consciousness, you know, might be.
Mm. How would you distinguish, for example, the state of flow, somebody completely absorbed in an activity where if you ask them afterwards describe what happened, they would tell you, well, there was no thoughts, there was no emotions, I was just completely absorbed in the moment.
Well, there's no description necessary. You just did it. You just said it.
Yeah, you're right. but the sense of, what's the distinction between that, let's say, that experience and an experience of, you say, of ecstasy?
Well, ecstasy, again, is a word, and we're using that word to refer to, you know, a state that people can sometimes enter into where they're feeling a kind of an exalted state, where they're feeling high.
Mm.
And the thing is again, it's very different for each person. For some people, experience an ecstatic state and be thinking at the same time, thinking ecstatic thoughts, you know. Other people may just naturally come into that ecstatic state in a kind of concept-free zone, you know, where no thoughts seem to exist. It's just like wide open space, and they're merging with wide open space, and it's hilariously rapturous to them.
Mm. How does the fifth circuit play on the other circuits of the first, the second, the third, or the fourth?
Oh, an excellent question. The way I've seen what I call the vertical connectivities between the upper and lower is, it seems to me that the fifth circuit acts as a kind of trigger for the first circuit, that they're related, the first and the fifth, and the first circuit can act as a kind of anchor or stabilizing influence for fifth circuit opening. I mean, when the fifth circuit really opens, it can be a wonderful, pleasurable, ecstatic experience, but if you stay there long enough, you get kind of spacey. Your energy kind of gets dispersed, and, you know, you're just kind of wandering around, kind of ungrounded or without anchor. So the first circuit, by entering into first circuit activity, like washing the dishes or doing the laundry or mowing the lawn or doing something physical, that begins to help stabilize and ground the fifth circuit overload of too much ecstasy.
And I think that's an important point that you're bringing out, that some people listening to this interview might think, oh, well, I need to get up all the way till the eighth circuit. But what you're saying is that it's way more dynamic, that the fifth circuit has its place in time, but the first circuit also.
Oh, yeah. See, they work together, as I see it. This is another way in which I've advance the eighth circuit brain system forward, because this, what I'm talking about, these vertical connectivities, have not been discussed by Leary or Wilson in their books. And it's a very specific connectivity I've discovered, not just between the first and the fifth, but also between the second and the sixth, the third circuit and the seventh circuit and the fourth circuit and the eighth circuit. And the lower circuits look to me like they can act, meaning, what I mean by lower circuits is that those experiences related to the bottom four circuits can act as a stabilizing and anchoring influence to the more volatile and expansive states of consciousness that are triggered when the upper circuit states open up.
Okay. So now we get to the sixth circuit.
Yeah. Which,
how would you describe that circuit?
Well, the sixth circuit refers to, sometimes I call it the psychic intelligence, and what I mean by psychic is simply the capacity to pay attention in a particular way. And when we speak of attention, I see two types of attention. One of them is the attention that is linked, it's that awareness linked to the thinking machine, the automatic assignment of meaning to what you're thinking about, and labeling, always labeling. Mm. Now, most people, and also in this society, Western society, tends to be very top-heavy, very much into the thinking of things and always assigning meanings and labels to things and needing that. That type of attention is often confused to being the only type of attention.
Which would be third circuit.
Yeah, more third circuit. So there's this other kind of attention I call second attention, which refers to that awareness linked to presence and phenomena and energy, but without assigning any labels or meanings to what you see.
Hmm.
So it's a process of a kind of direct perception of phenomena of energy without the immediate trying to categorize or analyze or interpret or put a label on it. And so it really indicates the sixth circuit, a certain type of seeing, of real genuine seeing, seeing into the inner nature of things. And so in the sixth circuit, you have sometimes attributes like clairvoyance or clairaudience and different types of psychic abilities that haven't even, you know, found a name for yet. But typically, you know, these upper circuits can be activated on purpose with certain types of like drugs like LSD, psilocybin, but they also can be activated, you know, accidentally by certain types of outside shocks. You know, certain types of experiences leave us in a state of heightened uncertainty, and that would address the shock of the sixth circuit, the shock of uncertainty.
With your paratheater, how do you activate the sixth circuit?
Well, that's a whole different conversation, a whole different interview there.
Okay,
but yeah, this paratheater is basically it's a whole medium of physical discipline and expression, but that we use ritual processes that we develop that have the effect of triggering, you know, higher states of consciousness, but through the body, through an embodied bias and expression. So, you know, we're not just sitting around holding hands and meditating. You know, we're you know, moving around. We're sweating and we're gaining access to energy centers really embedded in the body itself, and we're relating to those energies as movement resources. So it's a movement-oriented medium, but one that's animated by energy centers and sources in the body.
Okay. What's when you talk about presence of the sixth circuit and being also present in the fifth circuit, what is the distinction between the two?
Well, in the fifth circuit, you know, it's the experience is not so much where you're seeing energies. It's more simple than that, where it's more like you're just being the experience. There's this kind of identification with the oneness of everything.
Mm.
And, you know, people who smoke marijuana, for example, know all about the fifth circuit because that's cannabis is a natural fifth circuit catalyst or activator. LSD, psilocybin, mescaline, those types of psychoactive drugs are natural sixth circuit catalyst or activators. Now, I don't myself partake in marijuana or LSD. I used to many, many, many years ago. But I rely on my work in paratheater now to, you know, access some of this, you know, the same chemistry in my own brain that taking drugs, you know, many years ago catalyzed for me, but in a more out of control way, and I was uncomfortable with being out of control.
Right. What about now the seventh circuit?
Now the seventh circuit, we get into some very very rare types of experiences, and that's what I call mythopoetic genetic intelligence. And this is really intelligence that we can experience in those moments where we come into some kind of cognition of participating on a, how can I put it, on a more cosmic scale where interaction with the plant life of the planet and with nature, not in any kind of merging, like all is one kind of way, which is more of the fifth circuit, but in the seventh circuit, you know, you have those kind of more extreme experiences of being, let's say, your consciousness is flooded by memories from, let's say, past lives, or maybe you are interacting with archetypes that appeared in your dreams, but now you are starting to experiencing them in your waking life. And so the seventh circuit opens you up to that awareness of the overlay between the dream time and the daytime. So with the Aborigines in many tribal cultures, you know, they have dream time traditions, dream time rituals at the heart of their spirituality. They take dreams much more seriously than us modern folk. And part of this is the seventh circuit awareness that, you know, can be more active in the tribal people who are closer to the earth, but also closer to you know, the interconnectedness between all living forms, and DNA being, you know, the language of all life, and the interconnectedness of life being symbolized by DNA, and you know, so the language of the planet. Speaking through DNA, through all things, through all living things. So anyway, these kinds of awarenesses and experiences of feeling interconnected with all living things, with all of life, and then coming into some kind of experience of the overlay between the daytime experience of your life and the dream time experience of existence. Mm. That would be starting to come into more seventh circuit type of consciousness and experience.
And these higher circuits, the fifth, the sixth, the seventh, and what we're going to be talking about, the eighth,
yeah,
they're very difficult to talk about because we're going beyond language.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
We're trying to put words to things that don't have actual words. So poetry and art seems to be easier to represent these type of states or experiences.
Well, that's right. That's exactly right. I don't know about the easy part, you know, because artists and poets have to struggle, too, to get to find the... you know, some kind of language or expression for these ineffables.
Yeah.
But absolutely, you know, poetry and music and cinema, too. Mm-hmm. This is one of the main reasons why I make films, because it provides me an outlet for some of the visions and impressions that without which I wouldn't have a medium or language to communicate it, and it would just be too much for me to carry around without sharing it with other people.
Mm. And the Eighth Circuit...
Eighth circuit refers to quantum out-of-body intelligence. And the eighth circuit opens up in those experiences that have been called out-of-body experiences, basically, where you come into some direct experience of yourself outside of the physical body. Now, everybody that dreams and can remember their dreams has some reference to, you know, this eighth circuit reality through the dream body, through, you know, that dream ego that, you know, has adventures in dreamland. But according to certain Aboriginal cultures, they suggest that when we wake up in the morning, it's actually the dream body that's gone to sleep to dream us awake. And so the eighth circuit really opens up the possibility that everything is a dream, that we are being dreamed, we are dreaming, and we are being dreamed. And so the whole notion of individual ego is totally disintegrated, becomes completely irrelevant at the eighth circuit level. And it's just basically the flux of dreaming. And so, and there's a number of you know, ways in which people can come into Eighth Circuit experience, especially in any event that brings about a profound awareness of impermanence. So the shock, the particular shock of the Eighth Circuit is the shock of impermanence. And it's only a shock to the ego, because impermanence is, you know, it's a fact. You know, things come and go. What lasts, really, when you really, you know, look at things?
How do these circuits and maps help us understand better our current time? It seems that things in the last 5-10 years, and especially in the last 2-3 years, we've seen a lot of changes socially. How do you see that these maps and circuits can make better sense of our collective experience?
Well, quite frankly, I think it's too late to seek understanding of the times. I think it's too late for anything but navigation.
What do you mean by that?
What I mean by navigation is I use, for example, this particular grid to find different ways in which I can navigate, which is to say to move through my daily existence and to be able to move with more fluidity, more flexibility, more awareness, to be able to navigate, to move through.
Okay.
Like the word cyber, for example, you know, is a Latin word that goes back and it refers to some kind of steersman or pilot, to be able to navigate your existence. There's so much change happening right now. There's so much cross currents of all different types of directions that anybody that proposes that they understand what's going on, I think, is, you know, lying. I think it's too late for understanding. Mm. It's time for realization of yourself as an entity capable of navigating the currents. And if we navigate the currents, we find out where things are going. We may not know where they're going, but if we can navigate, we're going to find out. But without navigational capacity, you know, we just can, you know, go in circles and remain confused, or, you know, continue with the unnecessary or meaningless suffering in our lives.
To finish off this very interesting interview, and to the listeners, this was a very quick expose of the Eight Circuits, and people can learn more about the Eight Circuits looking at your books, Angel Tech and the Eight Circuit Brain. And where can they find these books?
Well, they're in international distribution. Angel Tech is also available through the publisher, the original Falcon Press. And the Eighth Circuit Brain is through another publisher, and that is Vertical Pool Publications. But, you know, if you go to your, you know, local bookstore and order it, they'll be able to do it, because it's in national, actually it's in, they're both in international distribution. I would also recommend Bob Wilson's book, Prometheus Rising, and Timothy Leary's book, Info Psychology.
Finish off the interview. What keeps you very excited and vibrant about life right now?
Right now? Well, you know, this, you know, conversing, you know, with you on intelligent topics, I love interacting, you know, with other intelligent people on topics that interest me. Currently, I'm in the process of editing a video document on the paratheater processes I've been developing, and that should be available in the fall. The video is called Paratheatrical Research. It'll be out on DVD, and it will feature what we call a dreaming ritual, which is a ritual I've been developing for about 20 years. It's created by recalling movements from dreams that you can replicate upon awakening, and putting these movements together to form a choreography that you perform while physically active and awake, that invokes the presence and power of dreaming in motion.
Interesting. Thank you very much, Antero.
He's an interesting fella, you know. Beyond the Eight Circuits, there's the films, the theatrical stuff, the movement stuff.
Yeah, he's a very complete person as an artist, touching on different fields and trying to make connections, which I think is very creative of him. So Entar Ali, you know, like he said, you can pick up his books, you can pick up Robert Anton Wilson's books, you can pick up Timothy Leary's book to learn more about the Eighth Circuit Mind and be able to understand how, you know, First Circuit has to do with feeling panic and looking for safety up to the Eighth Circuit, which is an out-of-body experience as much as you could have on an operating table or if you're being mauled by a bear.
Mauled by a bear?
Mauled by a bear.
Mauled by a bear.
And you decide to surrender to that beast. So, new maps to guide us. This is the show. This is the episode.
So we're going to turn now to something called Suki. And Suki is a web application. You can use it on your mobile phone. And it allows protesters that are being corralled by police to refer to a map that that allows them to sort of take note of police activities and to react, to prevent themselves from getting kettled.
So using technology to inform people who are protesting as to where the cops are.
Pretty much, yeah. I've got a clip here. We're going to listen to it real quick. It's from the makers of the actual application.
Kettling is an aggressive crowd control tactic employed by the police. The origin of the term comes from the way it creates pressure. Police cordons trap a crowd in one place without food or water for many hours. They squash the crowd into a smaller and smaller area, and they become stressed, panicked, and eventually exhausted. Once released, demonstrators have little more than enough energy to get home. Kettling has been criticized for suspending human rights, which is where Suki comes in.
Suki works like a personal news desk for demonstrators, providing an overall view of what's going on. This is made up by crowdsourcing reports from people at the demo who use Suki, and feeds from those using social and traditional media in order to report on the activities of the day.
So, Suki...
That's the worst name I've ever heard for an app.
Yeah, well, I guess, I mean, as long as you're pronouncing it properly, it's all right. The way it works is that it provides an interactive map for people that are able to access it through the internet via a laptop or more appropriately, probably a cellular phone running iOS or running Android. The system allows protesters, as they're encountering police, to submit reports that are then posted on Suki and are available to other people involved in a protest. So it gives immediate, swift feedback to protesters who may be being kettled by police. It allows them to change their route, change their plans appropriately to avoid getting into that sort of a situation.
So they know in real time where the cops are.
Yeah, the real-time aspect of it. Really,
it's like having an helicopter. Kind of like surveilling the city.
It's like having 100 helicopters.
Yeah.
So basically, an application like Suki allows us to get a bird's eye view, not necessarily of the map, but of what the map is meant to represent. Can we say that it allows us to be the map, to be the full representation of the social framework that we want to understand?
At the very least, Alex, it allows us to be one point on the map.
So as we wrap up the second edition of On High Alert, I want to personally dedicate this edition to all of our buds who are in the streets of Montreal tonight. I'm going to be joining them very shortly. Montreal and Quebec residents, actually, because it is a Quebec-wide movement, have taken to the streets to denounce the draconian steps that our government has taken. These increasingly drastic infringements on our basic right to free expression. I hope that none of my friends get kettled tonight. I hope no one gets kettled tonight. And Thibaut, I think you've got something that we can maybe sign off with.
That's right. And to finish off the show, we're going to have Joey Cape playing live in Montreal the song Oh Montreal here on High Alert.
Winter's day, years to come, fill your shield. according to why would you stay when you are poor and beautiful? Never trust a hotel clock. She'll be true with those you love, but not so much. Cause nothing's less. Still I could find you a Montreal.
You've been listening to an action-packed episode of High Alert. High Alert can be found online at highalert.net and on Twitter at High Alert Show. To communicate with Tebo, Alex, and George, send an email to info@highalert.net. For more information about Esteban Kelly, visit blackmaps.wordpress.com. For more information about Antero Ali, visit paratheatrical.com. For more information about Suki, visit opensuki.org. High Alert is recorded at Barsonic Studios in Montreal, Quebec. More information can be found at barsonic.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time on High Alert!